All right, so let's begin. So today, I thought that to lead on or to carry on from the theme of my weekend retreat last week, where we talked about values, shared values, and kindful speech. In that retreat, I mentioned a particular sutta called the Gosingasala Sutta. Actually, it's actually called the Mahagosinga Sutta. It's Majjhima number 32. I thought this might be nice. I mentioned it in the retreat because it talks about the meeting of many of the chief disciples of the Buddha and their conversation about their own values, we could say, their own qualities and the kind of things that they really aspire to develop in themselves and that they think are admirable and beautiful, virtuous qualities of the heart. And it's interesting to notice that, okay, we can all share certain values in our life, especially we hope that our ethical values are shared, because ethical values are something quite universal and quite timeless in their in the power of ethics and ethical values to bring about happiness. It's almost like a universal law of nature that if we come from a place of non-greed, non-hate, and non-delusion, it is going to lead towards happiness. Maybe we don't experience that immediately, but it will be the case in the long term. And on the other side, if our values and behaviors, thoughts, actions are coming from greed, hate, and delusion, and or, and it's usually a combination of the three, then they're going to lead towards our suffering. So, ethical values are what we're aiming at, and certain values we share in common, which are ethically aligned, and certain values are very unique to each of us, and they may or may not be particularly ethical. So, it's nice to read this sutta because it's talking about, to me, how we can bring our own particular qualities to community or to society. And perhaps together we can enrich the societies we live in by having certain things in common and certain things that are our own unique strengths. So, shall we begin? It's a little bit of a longer sutta than I usually do, but because it's not really about the practices themselves, it's not a particularly doctrinal text, it may be fairly quick to read through, and I thought it might be quite a rich discussion to have because it will help us each reflect on the values we hold to be very important in our lives. And I think it's always good to reflect in this way, perhaps especially at the beginning of the year. And yes, it is still January. Can you believe it? It's the longest month of the year. So, anyway, shall we begin? So this is Majjhima number 32, the Mahagosinga Sutta, or the Greater Discourse in Gosinga. Oh, the other thing I should say before we start is that a very warm welcome to our Norwegian friend Ellen, who's just arrived. Nice to see you there. But also, depending on how this goes, we may have questions and discussion as usual in the group. But it may be that I could suggest we have little breakout rooms as well. So, and in a way, it's like depends on how the evening flows and maybe what we feel inclined to do, how much time there is. But if that is something that seems beneficial, then I really encourage you to join those little groups. So, let's see. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the park of the Gosingasala tree wood, together with a number of very well-known elder disciples. And these are monks. Of course, this could equally have happened with nuns, but these things aren't really recorded in the texts. The Venerable Sariputta, the Venerable Mahamoggallana, the Venerable Mahakasapa, the Venerable Aniruddha, the Venerable Revata and the Venerable Ananda and other very well-known elder disciples. Let's hope that the bhikkhunis were there as well. Then, when it was evening, the Venerable Mahamoggallana rose from meditation and went to the Venerable Mahakasapa and said to him, "Friend Kasapa, let us go to the Venerable Sariputta and listen to the Dhamma." "Yes, friend," the Venerable Mahakasapa replied. Then the Venerable Mahamoggallana The Venerable Mahakasapa and the Venerable Anuruddha went to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma. So the Venerable Sariputta is the Buddha's so-called right-hand disciple and chief in wisdom, equal to the Buddha himself. Venerable Mahamoggallana was the other chief disciple on the left, right hand, left hand, and he was foremost in psychic powers. Venerable Mahakasapa was kind of foremost in asceticism, and he became almost like the father of the Sangha after the Buddha attained parinibbana, after the Buddha's khandhas ceased. The two first chief disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, had already passed away, and the Venerable Mahakasapa was the next in line. And the Venerable Anuruddha, who was also mentioned here, is one of the Buddha's cousins. Okay, and then Ananda comes in. The Venerable Ananda was the Buddha's attendant for, I think, 35 years from the time he was enlightened, more or less, and he's also a cousin. So the Venerable Ananda saw them going to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma. Thereupon he went to the Venerable Revata and said to him, "Friend Revata, those true men, or those true monastics, are going to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma. Let us also go to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma." "Yes, friend," the Venerable Revata replied. And then the Venerable Revata and the Venerable Ananda went to the Venerable Sariputta to listen to the Dhamma. It's getting really exciting. It's like when you say, "I'm going to this show. Do you want to go to this show?" "Oh, yeah, you're going. Can you get me a ticket as well?" Only this is actually to listen to the chief disciple of the Buddha. Can you imagine the interest and excitement there? I think I'd want to follow along. The Venerable Sariputta saw the Venerable Revata and the Venerable Ananda coming in the distance and said to the Venerable Ananda, "Let the Venerable Ananda come. Welcome to the Venerable Ananda, the Blessed One's attendant, who's always in the Blessed One's presence. Friend Ananda, the Gosingasala wood is delightful. The night is moonlit and the sala trees are all in blossom, with heavenly scent and heavenly scents seem to be floating in the air." That's a pretty warm welcome, isn't it? And do you notice also how the Venerable Sariputta is already rejoicing in the qualities of Venerable Ananda, who is his junior in terms of monastic life and also his level of understanding of the Dhamma at this time. And yet he is expressing that kind of appreciation and respect. So then the Venerable Sariputta says, "What kind of monastic, friend Ananda, could illuminate the Gosingasala tree wood?" So then the Venerable Anuruddha replies, "Here, friend Sariputta, a monastic has learned much, remembers what they've learned, and consolidates what they've learned. Such teachings that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Good here really means beneficial. With the right meaning and phrasing, and which affirm a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Such teachings as these they've learned much of, remembered, mastered verbally, investigated with the mind, and penetrated well by view." In other words, they've realized these things through direct experience. "And they teach the Dhamma to the four assemblies." That's the assembly of bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen, and it includes everybody, whether you're lay, whether you're monastic, and whatever gender you are, "with well-rounded and coherent statements and phrases for the eradication of the underlying tendencies. That kind of monastic could illuminate this Gosingasala tree wood." Sounds like a pretty cool monk or nun. "When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the Venerable Revata thus, 'Friend Revata, the Venerable Ananda has spoken according to his own inspiration. Now we ask the Venerable Revata, friend Revata, the Gosingasala tree wood is delightful. The night is moonlit. The sala trees are all in blossom and heavenly scents seem to be floating in the air. What kind of monastic, friend Revata, could illuminate this Gosingasala tree wood?'" So he answers to the Venerable Sariputta, Here, friend Sariputta, a monastic delights in solitary meditation and takes delight in solitary meditation. They're devoted to internal serenity of mind. Do not neglect meditation. Possess insight and dwell in empty hearts. That kind of monastic could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood. When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the Venerable Anuruddha thus. Friend Anuruddha, the Venerable Revata has spoken according to his own inspiration. Now we ask the Venerable Anuruddha the same question. So I won't keep repeating the little refrain, but he's also talking about this beautiful, delightful wood. What kind of person could illuminate it further? So the friend Anuruddha says, "Here, friend Sariputta, with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, a monastic surveys 1,000 worlds. Just as a person with good sight, when they've ascended to the upper palace chamber, might survey 1,000 wheel rims, so too with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, a monastic surveys 1,000 worlds. That kind of monastic could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood." When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the Venerable Mahakasapa in the same way. And the Venerable Mahakasapa says, "Friend Sariputta, a bhikkhu or a monastic is a forest dweller himself or themselves and speaks in praise of forest dwelling. They're an alms food eater themselves and speak in praise of eating alms food. They're a refuse rag wearer themselves and speak in praise of wearing refuse rag robes. They're a triple robe wearer themselves and speaks in praise of wearing the triple robe. They have few wishes themselves and speak in praise of fewness of wishes. They're content themselves and speak in praise of contentment. They're secluded themselves and speak in praise of seclusion. They're aloof from society themselves and speak in praise of aloofness from society. They're energetic themselves and speak in praise of arousing energy. Have attained to virtue themselves and speak in praise of the attainment of virtue. They've attained to stillness, samadhi we can say, themselves, and speak in praise of the attainment of samadhi. And they've attained to wisdom themselves and speak in praise of the attainment of wisdom. They've attained to deliverance and speak in praise of the attainment of deliverance, attained to knowledge and vision of deliverance, and speak in praise of the attainment of the knowledge and vision of deliverance. That kind of monastic could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood." Shall I continue, or shall we already have a bit of conversation? Continue through? Yes. How's everyone in here? Good. When this was said, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the Venerable Mahamoggallana thus, in the same way. "Here, friend Sariputta, two monastics engage in talk on the higher Dhamma, and they question each other, and each being questioned by the other, answers without foundering, and their talk rolls on in accordance with the Dhamma. That kind of bhikkhu or monastic could illuminate the Gosinga Sala tree wood." That's interesting, because until now all the monastics have been speaking about the qualities they see in themselves and the things that they're speaking about from experience and also to their own particular strengths. And now the Venerable Mahamoggallana actually speaks about engaging in talk on the higher Dhamma, questioning one another and answering without foundering, their talk rolling on in accordance with the Dhamma. So as I said in the beginning, the Venerable Mahamoggallana was actually a foremost in psychic powers. So it's interesting to me that he describes this. Perhaps it's due to his close relationship with Venerable Sariputta and the fact that they used to like to talk about the Dhamma. Perhaps that could even be seen as a psychic power, teaching the Dhamma, talking about the Dhamma. There is one place in the suttas where the Buddha says that teaching the Dhamma is the best of all the psychic powers. So it's all right to see a thousand world systems. It might be quite a fun thing to do. What do you think? But it's a product of the practice, right? It's not necessarily an attainment worth seeking out. And when I practiced in Myanmar, I must say it was quite common for people to have these kind of psychic powers because it was a very simple society and people were brought up with a lot of virtue, a lot of reverence for the Dhamma, very good sila, a lot of generosity, and also a lot of suffering, right? Which probably compelled people to really take the practice seriously. And it wasn't at all uncommon in any meditation center or not even necessarily the senior monk or nun, for people to talk about these kind of things, almost like going down to the shop and buying rye bread instead of sourdough. And my teacher would say, it's okay to play around a little bit, but don't get distracted, don't get lost. Don't get lost in these things. And sometimes he talks so much about devas and different beings that he would be able to see with his divine eye, that I think, shouldn't he be paying more attention to us than to the devas? Is he hanging out with them all the time? So, anyway, interesting to me that Mahamoggallana talks about that. So, when this was said, the Venerable Mahamoggallana now talks to the Venerable Sariputta. Friend Sariputta, who's been the one who's been questioning the others. We have all spoken according to our own inspiration. Now we ask the Venerable Sariputta, Friend Sariputta, the Gosinga solitary wood is delightful. The night is moonlit. The sala trees are all in blossom, and heavenly scents seem to be floating in the air. What kind of person or monastic, Friend Sariputta, could illuminate this Gosinga solitary wood? Here, Friend Moggallana, a monastic wields mastery over their mind. They do not let the mind wield mastery over them. In the morning, they abide in whatever abiding or attainment they want to abide in during the morning. At midday, they abide in whatever attainment or abiding they want to abide in at midday. Did I say midday? That was supposed to be at midday. In the evening, they abide in whatever abiding or attainment they want to abide in during the evening. Suppose a king or a king's minister had a chest full of variously coloured garments. In the morning, they could put on whatever pair of garments they wanted to put on in the morning. At midday, they could put on whatever pair of garments they wanted to put on at midday. In the evening, the same. So, too, a person wields mastery over their mind and does not let the mind wield mastery over them. And in the morning, at midday, and in the evening, they abide in whatever abiding or attainment they want to abide in at that time. That kind of person could illuminate this Gosinga solitary wood. Would you like that, to be able to say, okay, mind, I want you to stop thinking now, or I want you to be full of loving kindness, or I want you to enter the cessation of perception and feeling. What about that? Wouldn't that be incredible? So this is what the Venerable Sariputta values and no doubt can do himself. Then the Venerable Sariputta addressed those venerable ones thus, Friends, we've all spoken according to our own inspiration. Let us go to the Blessed One and report this matter to him. As the Blessed One answers, so let us remember it. So then they repeat the whole thing to the Buddha, and I'm going to do the dot dot dots now because they're basically saying word for word, which shows how brilliant their memories were and how much a part of their life and the preservation of Dhamma depended on this kind of recitation and memory and repeating it then to the teacher as well. So they all repeat it word for word to the Buddha and ask for the Buddha's input on that. And at every time that they describe what a particular monk has said, the Buddha says, "Good, good. This monk, speaking rightly, should speak as they did. So when it came to Venerable Revata, for example, they say, good, good, Sariputta, Revata, Venerable Revata, speaking rightly, should speak just as he did, for Revata delights in solitary meditation, takes delight in solitary meditation, is devoted to internal serenity of mind, does not neglect meditation, possesses insight, and dwells in empty hearts. And the same for everybody else. So good, good. Anuruddha, speaking rightly, should speak just as he did. For with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, Anuruddha surveys 1,000 worlds. Interestingly, in Bhantisarjato's translation, instead of saying he's spoken to his own inspiration or speaking rightly, I think he says something like this person spoke according to what was right for him. So it's the same sentiment, but it's implying that they're speaking with a level of integrity here, right? They're speaking in a way that they actually practice. And I think this is one of the important things about values when we reflect on the values we hold as the most important and the kind of guiding principles of our lives. Sometimes we can hold them very dearly, but we're not really giving them the priority they deserve in our lives. And I think one of the beautiful things here is that the monastics were actually gaining inspiration in the way they practiced and being able to rejoice in that, being able to rejoice in their own ethical integrity. So we're nearly at the end of the reading. So the Buddha is just confirming everybody's statement and saying that they've spoken well. And then when this was said, the Venerable Sariputta asks the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, which of us has spoken well? In other words, who's right? Is there a right or a wrong? And the Buddha says, you've all spoken well, Sariputta, each in your own way. Hear also from me, what kind of bhikkhu, what kind of monastic could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood? Hear, Sariputta, when a monastic has returned from their arms round and after their meal, they sit down, fold their legs crosswise, set their body erect, and establishing mindfulness in front of them. This is Satim Parimukkam Upattapetva. It's the little refrain that happens at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta that is often translated as establishing one's mindfulness around the mouth. Parimukkam, which means here. And this is what actually a lot of meditation teachers teach in Myanmar, that we should establish our mindfulness near to this area where the breath comes in and the breath goes out. But Ajahn Brahm's kind of railed against that, and here also the Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi has agreed to translate it as establishing mindfulness in front of one. I think since this, actually, Ajahn Brahm's further said that it doesn't even mean physically in front, because in front of one, where do you exist? Where about is one? I know, in front of your belly? Is your belly who you are? Is your big toe who you are? So in front of one, it's again kind of spatial, right? And awareness doesn't really happen in a place. So the Buddha, Ajahn Brahm, says that what it really means is to establish mindfulness first of all. In other words, to establish mindfulness as a priority. Parimukkam. Anyway, so establishing mindfulness in front or as a priority, one resolves, I shall not break this sitting position until, through not clinging, my mind is liberated from the taints. That means from all the defilements. This kind of monastic could illuminate this Gosinga Sala tree wood. That is what the Blessed One said. Those venerable ones were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. It doesn't say they became enlightened, because they were pretty much all enlightened already. And in a way, each person's little inspiration and what they, the kind of person they thought could illuminate the forest, were all pointing at, you know, deep wisdom and attainments. So that is the sutta. And we actually talked about this at tea time recently. It was interesting because one of the people said that they were surprised that the monks were basically valuing qualities that they had themselves. In other words, they were in a way praising themselves, right? Which may seem kind of counterintuitive, or maybe it is something that monks are likely to do, perhaps see things through their own eyes in that way. And we were thinking that would it be any different if there's a group of women or a group of gender diverse folks or a mixed group of people? Would we all be saying that? You know, kind of bringing up our own particular strengths? Or maybe we'd be looking at strengths that we don't yet have. I don't know. But it would be interesting to hear what people in the room think about this, and whether there's anyone you related to the most, or whether for you a completely different kind of practitioner would illuminate the forest. So I would love to open it up for any discussion and thoughts you may have. So Manori, coming to you.
Yeah, so I was thinking they are very senior monks and they have this perfect qualities in their mind, and they have achieved those qualities. They have attained those qualities, so and they have completed, and so that those are the qualities that they think the perfect, the highest. So they're confident. They're confident in it. I don't see that they are bragging about it, but no. I hear a confidence.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great. That's beautiful. I definitely don't think they're bragging either, not at all. It's just kind of interesting that they do talk about their attainments. I think there was a thing in the Buddha's day where you would do what they used to call a lion's roar, and it would be seen as something inspirational, you know, especially if it's coming from a person who has those qualities. So you give your lion's roar and you kind of embody what you're saying, and it has that extra power because of that. So yeah, I think you're right about that. It's quite different probably from how we might feel about our developing qualities that are not yet perfected. Yeah, I'll come to Shirley and then to the chat. Hi, can you unmute?
I think I'm really going to echo what Manori said. I think they were all enlightened, fully enlightened, apart from Ananda, but he was, I think, at least a stream enterer. So they got ego, and so they were just able to say, look, I've got this beautiful quality. And I was reading, when I was at the Vihara, I was reading about this eminent laywoman who actually praised herself in front of Sariputta, I think.
Brilliant.
And it was just really weird. And I thought, yes, but she'd gone be, and they were just rejoicing in their own, they were just rejoicing in the beauty of their own actions.
Yeah.
There wasn't any ego there at all.
Right.
So they'd be able to rejoice in their own actions and other people's actions without any ego at all.
Yes.
But, so that's nothing really new, because that's really what Manori said. But I'd just like to add that from me, the person that would illuminate the Gusinga Grove would be somebody practicing the Brahma Viharas.
Yeah, fantastic. So is that what you actually orient yourself to?
It's interesting, because I think I'd rather have wisdom, because actually I was actually bursting with metta when I did the metta meditation after returning from the Vihara, and I was sort of bursting with energy and metta. And ever since then, it's gone sort of really flat and dull and a bit grumpy and a bit uninspired.
Oh,
I mean, I haven't been... and then I thought, well, it's just...
normal.
It's just impermanence. That's okay. Yeah. I don't have to... And I think you often said that actually practicing the Brahma Viharas, it's not, you don't always feel this lovely, you want to feel all this, but it's actually working on it, and then just sort of saying, well, no, I'm not going to dwell in this grumpiness. I'm going to try and wish these people well. And I, you know, going to that intention, which is what you said.
Mm.
So maybe I would incline to wisdom actually, and actually you know, as I'm saying this now, although I find the Brahma Viharas inspiring and they draw me and they inspire me, then Until we've perfected, we're not always going to feel them. So we've just got to do the best we can with whatever wisdom and whatever we've got, I suppose.
Yeah, thanks. It's interesting that you're talking about the two as slightly different, because I wonder, from what you were describing, whether the wisdom into impermanence arose through the practice of the Brahma Viharas and through seeing the different shades of the Brahma Viharas, you know, the arising and the passing, as you were saying. So the Brahma Vihara actually did lead to some wisdom, and maybe that's all part and parcel of the practice.
It was seeing it pass away and not being me and mine.
Yes, good. Because there is a sort of...
Maybe that's what should be the one that illuminates, rather than actually just simply having metta. Because that just leads to the Brahma realms, doesn't it? It's not going to enlighten us.
I think there's different levels of purification of loving kindness. I mean, if you are fully enlightened, your metta is...
Well, absolutely.
Unsurpassed. You know, the compassion is at its peak. So it's actually the, like everything in the Dhamma, there are different sort of degrees, and it's a trajectory, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So there are specific suttas that talk about the kind of wisdom that can manifest specifically through the metta practice. And one of them is wisdom into the fact that these are conditioned states, into the impermanent nature of the states themselves. So I actually think the two are working together to dig deeper. As the wisdom increases, the metta flows more easily. As the metta flows more easily, there's more wisdom. So, yeah, they whirl around each other. But thanks for that. That's wonderful. Yeah. So there's a couple of questions in the chat or comments. Since there's no separation, isn't it just a way to celebrate the different manifestations of nobility or beneficial qualities in the relative realm? Yeah, absolutely, it's a way. I don't know what you mean by no separation exactly. I don't think that was necessarily a sort of sentence or a particular teaching that the Buddha gave. It's a popular one in modern-day Buddhism in some traditions. But I think perhaps what I notice, and maybe what you're pointing to here, is that these qualities all kind of overlap, really. And it's not that one is better than another. You know, there's wisdom and compassion, there's compassion and wisdom. If you have divine eye, it probably means you have very, very deep samadhi, right? If you have deep samadhi, you will have got a lot of wisdom, because samadhi leads to seeing things as they truly are. So I think that's right. And I think it's one of the reasons I find this so beautiful, is that it's a kind of celebration, and these things manifest differently for different people. So, yeah, it's quite a beautiful explanation if you take the whole sutta of the various results of practice that are available. And we may be stronger in some than in others. Yeah. Nandamata was the confident laywoman Shirley spoke about. Yeah, Nandamata. She was one of the foremost female lay disciples. And there was Nanda Pitta as well. Basically the mother and father of Nanda. And I think she was, you know, the wiser one of the two. I don't know. I think they were both stream winners, at least, if not Anagamis, I'm not sure. But yeah, she was certainly very wise. So thanks for that. I would be curious to start kind of inquiring among ourselves what kind of qualities we think would be worth cultivating, or what kind of qualities do you see in yourself, and be honest about it. You know, what are your values, what kind of qualities are you starting to see and be able to celebrate in yourself? This is an unusual kind of line of questioning, I think, for most people raised in Western societies, or societies where we're taught to kind of be extremely critical, self-effacing, or even downright denigrating of ourselves. And remember, this isn't a practice that's enhancing the sense of self. We're just doing this to actually celebrate qualities that can lead us beyond identifying with a permanent self. And if you don't want to speak here, we could put you in the little groups. What do you think? Shall we do that? And you could talk together about your values, maybe some values that you've seen change, or that you'd like to cultivate this year. Shall we do that? I'd be really up for doing it, as long as I don't lose too many of you, or any of you. Now we've got suddenly two questions. All right, we'll go for a couple of these and then we'll consider doing the groups. So, Joseph. Hi.
Hello, Venerable. I
Hello.
just I liked how you I think you mentioned that Venerable Mahayana was the father of the Sangha, so it just kind of stood out to me hearing you talk about. I'm thinking about him right now. I was going to say Venerable Subhuti. I'm really grateful you taught us the non-conflict sutta. I think that's another quality I would like to cultivate more, non-conflict. But in terms of something that I'm really grateful for is kind of the way that Ajahn Brahmapaad Metta was like, you know, the kitten analogy, you know, imaginary, having like an imaginary kitten. And these past few days, I've been thinking about recollecting the arahants as a metta object, you know, as like the best friend, you know, the arahants are respectfully, of course, you know, and remembering what are the qualities of an arahant. I noticed that they came up with Mahakachana talking about how he had fulfilled ethics, samadhi, wisdom, liberation, knowledge, and vision of liberation, and seeing those as sublime qualities to rejoice in. You know, directing the Brahma Viharas towards the Arahants, I feel like would be a really inspiring, having joy for the Arahants, having care for the Arahants, having friendliness towards three perfected ones. Rejoicing and being peaceful and wishing to be peaceful like the Arhats, I think, is something sublime. I just felt inspired to share that and rejoice in that with you all. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Certainly, I think when we reflect on qualities that we admire, in a way, we're inviting them to start developing in our hearts, aren't we? We're bringing them to mind and we're valuing them. We're putting them at the front of our mind. Anyone in here? Otherwise, I'll come to Benjamin.
Hello.
Hi.
The thing that most struck me about the sutta, and which really gave me a lovely feeling, was the refrain about the beautiful wood in the moonlight with the trees in blossom and the heavenly scents. And it just gave this really peaceful picture of a place. And it's almost hard for me to even imagine such a place being illuminated more by a person being there. And I was thinking about this, and whatever other qualities they may have developed, I think really necessary to add anything is first to have the gentleness not to take away anything, not to impose on the place or to alter it by the force of your presence. And gentleness is a quality that I think is particularly important to me, one that I particularly try to develop, and I think I do a decent job. And I think it's something that's foundational in the practice, which maybe isn't spoken about very much.
Oh, thank you for that. That's really beautiful. Just talking about that and bringing up that beautiful image of the woods and the unimposing gentleness of these incredible beings is just so calming and soothing and ooh, I get the goosebumps. And maybe because you have that quality and you've pointed it out in such a beautiful way, it just resonates. Thank you. Yes, I think, the calligraphy that you do, I mean, that imbues that gentleness, that care and precision so well. That's lovely. Thank you. Hello, Jan. Am I pronouncing your name properly, or would you like to
It's you can pronounce it however you want. I don't know
pronounce?
mine really. But yeah, I wanted to talk about the to briefly mention the qualities that I think would enable a monk to illuminate a forest like that. And they're kind of the qualities that I inspire to develop, even though right now I think I'm not that good at it, but slowly we're going to get there, I hope. So something that Benjamin talked about that I actually didn't cross my mind, but I think it's probably the most important one for me, or one of the most important ones, is this gentleness, especially towards yourself. You know, he spoke of it in terms of the forest, but for me, it's really sometimes to have this gentleness towards yourself and others, not to try to force things to happen, to let them happen naturally on their own account, so to speak. And the other one is probably contentment.
Yeah.
That one for me is really important, because like we said, things are not always very bright. We are grumpy. We have many other different states. And if you show that contentment towards them, they're just really easy to deal with, so to speak. And the other one was kindness. A monk who is very kind towards other people, very sort of a warm attitude. He has a very warm attitude towards others. And the other one is a monk that is easy to admonish. This is another quality I've seen sometimes mentioned, I think, in the suttas.
Yeah.
Someone who is easy to admonish, who accepts criticism from others when needed.
Yeah, fantastic. Wow, thank you so much. They're beautiful qualities, and somehow they just go together so well. You know, the gentleness, and you were saying in the sense that gentleness means we're not forcing things to happen at a certain time. I often think of that as one of these three right intentions, you know, the one about avihimsaka, which is non-harming, but often translated by Ajahn Brahma's gentleness. And an aspect of that gentleness is patience. You know, real, genuine patience, which is understanding that, yeah, like you said, things will work out in their own time according to cause and effect, and we don't need to force it. In fact, we can't really force it.
Yeah.
And yeah, the contentment, the more we're content with what's here right now, the more we can really fully open to it and, yeah, allow that process. So they go very beautifully together. The kindness, of course, is also an aspect of that second factor of the Eightfold Path. So you're banging away at that point, and then gently. And then, yeah, the non-admonishment, the being able to accept feedback, the Buddha says again and again, a person who can't accept feedback is basically impossible to train. There's a sutta which actually relates it to being like a horse that's impossible to train, and you're just basically dead in the training. And I think it's because we lack, when we're so defensive, you know, of course we're not gentle, but we also lack that humility, which is a part, again, of gentleness. Yeah. So very beautiful. I like that. We should include that in the sutta. Lovely. Thank you for your contribution. And Marianne, have you got some aspirational qualities or...?
But the question that kind of came to me now was more in a direct kind of conversation with what is coming up here. Like, I really appreciate this emphasis on gentleness, on patience, on contentment, but then I also, so I don't have the memory that these of the monks of this time, so I don't remember word for word what was said in the sutta, but the contribution of the Buddha was like the person who just sits down and refuses to move until they achieved enlightenment. That doesn't sound extremely patient or extremely like a very non-forceful, gentle approach. It's, to me, when I hear that, it feels kind of stubborn and forceful and like not necessarily patient. So I was wondering if you could maybe either correct my understanding of that, or help me see how to reconcile.
Yeah, Yeah. I also felt the same when I read that, and we had a discussion here at tea time, and we're like, out of all the qualities that the Buddha pointed to, why did he point to this? In other words, out of all the qualities the Buddha was known for, right? Because for me, he was like Mahakarunika, the great compassionate one. That was how he was known. And obviously his major qualities were the wisdom and compassion. I mean, that seems kind of clear, right? He taught others out of compassion, out of anukampa for the world. That was the only reason he really continued after his parinibbana. He could have just said, right, that's it, I'm going to lay the khandhas down and you know, leave this world of suffering. But out of compassion, he continued. So I don't know whether it's in the context of trying to inspire younger people. I mean, maybe it's because obviously, it would be preserved for future generations. It could be just he was talking about that moment before his enlightenment. But I would imagine that because it's the Buddha, and because we have to assume that the Buddha has a lot of wisdom, and he knew what he was doing at this time, that perhaps he was full of patience. And by saying, I shall not break this sitting position until the mind is liberated, perhaps it was very obvious to him, having, you know, travelled through samsara for eons and eons and countless lives, that he was close to the end anyway. Perhaps that's the case, you know, perhaps he knew that the foundational practices were in place, the conditions were ripe, and all he needed to do was sit. I don't know if in that sitting and making that determination there was a lot of patience. You know, because, I mean, I know for myself, there's been times in my practice that I've made strong determinations that were actually quite easy to make because I was ready for them. So I've said, you know, okay, I'm going to sit for 6 hours without moving. And I did that for 2 or 3 years, like every day. And that was just part of the day's meditation. It was like a meditation from 12 noon till 6 p.m. And I can say for myself that because it was coming at a time that I was ready for that and it seemed like just a little stretch, there was a lot of patience and time kind of would pass me by. I mean, you had to be really present in the moment to do such a practice. So perhaps sometimes this can be helpful. And obviously in the Buddha's case, it worked. But I wouldn't recommend it for most people. Perhaps he's saying it because that's his special quality. And it's not necessarily something that can be generalized at all. I mean, there were other monastics like the Venerable Mahamoggallana who was actually sleeping and dozing off during the last couple of weeks before his enlightenment. And there was another place in the sutta as well where the Buddha saw two monastics meditating. One of them was sitting straight and meditating seemingly perfectly. The other was in the forest and sleepy. And the Buddha went to the one with the erect back. He mentioned to the Venerable Ananda, who was with him at that time as his attendant, he pointed to the one sitting straight and he said, I'm worried about that monk. And shortly afterwards, that monk disrobed. And then he pointed out the other person who was actually nodding and seeming to get nowhere. And he said, I'm not worried about that one. And that one actually broke through. So it may be different for different people, perhaps. And personally, I wouldn't suggest this to anyone. This is the Buddha. So I wouldn't suggest that. But I think we can assume he had a gentle approach even within that phenomenon. I don't know. There are a few thoughts that come to mind. See, now I mentioned small groups, you've all got your hands up. So I'm coming to Kalyan again.
If you want, you can... Juan can actually talk first because I already talked, you know.
Okay, sure. Thank you. That's very kind, Juan.
Yeah, I think it's very beautiful sutta, but when I listen to this sutta, and there's some confusion coming to my mind because I understand that one of the main principles in Buddhism is in no self. But through this sutta, I think lots of monks talk about their old quality.
Uh-huh.
I just wonder, is that also against no self? Or what's the difference between talking about their old quality and no self? Are they different? Yeah.
I think, you know, if a person has seen through non-self, then they are able to just observe phenomena and qualities as qualities, and there's not that attachment or identification with them. So if you actually see the language in this, nobody ever says, this kind of person who's just like me, or I am the kind of person who would illuminate this Sala forest, this, what is it called, Sala tree grove? Is that right? They don't actually speak in those terms. They're speaking in a different way about the qualities themselves. And I think this is one of the fears that we have when there is still a sense of self, that if we notice and recognize certain qualities within us, it might enhance the ego. But it actually doesn't when we understand that these qualities arise from certain causes and they have a certain effect on our mind. So the Buddha actually suggested that we should reflect frequently on the qualities that we see developing in ourselves. And it's more to encourage ourselves than to kind of get disheartened. I don't know about for you, it depends how we condition, but for me, it's much easier to kind of start contracting around a sense of self that's critical and that focuses on faults and thinking, oh, this is my weakness, this is what I did wrong. That tends to be when the sense of self gets kind of solidified. Whereas if I'm just seeing qualities in myself and I'm like able to accept or acknowledge that this is there, or at least this intention is there, then that's a cause for like uplifting the mind and freeing the mind from too much obsession about the self. Am I okay? Am I doing okay? Did I do something wrong? And it becomes more about something uplifting and inspirational. So I think in this case, they're actually talking in an inspired way about the qualities that are there. But to me, the point, one of the major points of this sutta is that it's that integrity. The fact that they're not praising anything that they're not practicing. Does that make sense? Because there are people in the world who, you know, will praise certain qualities and even attribute them to themselves, but then they don't practice them. So here, to me, it seems very kind of congruent with the way they actually practice. And these are just qualities that they appreciate. Does that make sense? I don't know. I mean, it's a good exploration to have, you know, to ask yourself, you know, will bringing up certain qualities and rejoicing in certain things in myself, will it enhance the ego, or is there a different way I can look at it?
Yeah, thank you. And I think, yes, that's a little bit confusing when we think about talking about, especially monk talking about their old quality and practice no self, then I don't know the border to distinguish between that two boundary, I think it's very grey and very hard to practice. Yeah. And yeah, anyway, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up. Yeah, that's great. Okay, so someone's saying, could part of the point be that different qualities can all lead to and be full expressions of the same enlightened state? Yes, absolutely. That's what I was sort of pointing to. I think that's the case. So each person should cultivate the ones that they're most able to express fully. Yeah, the ones they're most able to express fully. I mean, that's the case eventually, right? But it could also be the ones that we're more inspired by, that we're more naturally inclined towards, maybe that come easily to us. I mean, that's a whole other sort of realm of inquiry, isn't it? Do we develop the qualities that we're actually stronger in and just keep developing them, or do we work on the ones which we haven't given much attention to yet? I think a little bit of both is probably good. That's my feeling. I do go with my strengths. I acknowledge my strengths and kind of make much of them, but then sometimes there's times I say, okay, maybe this quality still needs some attention or a bit extra attention. So, yeah, we do have natural propensities in one direction or another. And again, that's not self. It's just due to causes and conditions. And also there may be external causes and conditions which enable you to develop certain qualities at a particular time. You know, if your day is very busy, we were talking about that this evening, or if we find that we're developing, you know, irritation or frustration, then and meeting a lot of people, having to meet a lot of people, then it might be a good idea to develop more loving kindness, right? Rather than, say, practice breath meditation or something else. But then in other situations, like when I'm on my AA's retreat, I know that I've got 3 months straight, almost, with less likelihood of being disturbed. So that's the time that I allow my mind to really cultivate anapana practice. So, yeah. I think also being able to acknowledge and kind of celebrate our own strengths is really important. Because we have something unique to contribute, each of us does. We're not all the same, and we don't need to all be the same, and the world would be a very boring and kind of scary place, wouldn't it, if we were all the same, my goodness. Your reference to the causes and conditions of such beneficial qualities was key for me and suggestive of anatta. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, we can actually take beneficial qualities as aspirations and try to see what causes and conditions incline the mind towards them. Or we can notice that we have certain qualities and undermine any sense of clinging or identification with those by realizing that these qualities have grown due to the way we were brought up, for example, due to the input we've had. I mean, sometimes, you know, you can see people in the world behaving in ways that just seem abhorrent and so, oh, you know, shocking, really. And I often remember when I see that, that these people haven't had the chance to hear the Dhamma. You know, they don't know the right path because they haven't had the chance to hear the Dhamma. I've had the chance to hear it. So, of course, it's less likely for me to behave in those ways. So to realize that everything is the product of causes and conditions, you know, even what we think of as choice, we only see a limited number of choices ahead of us, don't we? Even down to things like career choices. You know, I've been talking in the last couple of days with some friends about, you know, how does somebody get into that kind of line of work or that kind of job? How would you even know it was an option? And it's a whole train of very peculiar events and situations and traveling to certain places that then lead up to somebody, you know, finding a particular path in life that you'd never expect to find. So this is very much along the lines of non-self. Yeah. Maybe they can more deeply rejoice in the qualities that they see from personal experience has led them towards liberation and peace. Yeah. Yeah, because we have to remember, again, like I think Shirley and Minori said at the beginning, these people are free from the sense of self. They're enlightened. So we have to presume they don't have that personal identification. But they are able to rejoice in both the qualities that led them there and the qualities that are the outcome of their practice. Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. Anything from here? We've got 5 more minutes before we wind up. Have your perspectives changed? Because we talked about this, didn't we? We all came to one united opinion, actually, that the quality, what was that? We thought the person that could illuminate the forest is the personification of love.
Mm-hmm.
We all kind of thought that's the most important. Yeah. However you want to define that word. I actually think metta is love. Love is metta. And other ideas of what love is are sort of corruptions of that word, really. They're not the full purified thing. Hello, Ian.
Yeah, I was just going to give like a suggestion of why the Buddha suggested that particular quality.
Uh-huh.
Is the way I thought it could be that, you know, he went through a lot of things before he became enlightened. I think I remember there is a specific sutta where, you know, he outlines the various practices he tried before he remembered the jhanas from childhood. And they were all very... quite, they sounded quite uncomfortable and painful, to say the least. But at the end of the day, he managed to reach, you know, enlightenment because he made, you know, he was very resolute. He was very determined.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe by, you know, outlining this determination to sit until all of the defilements are gone, it's probably, you know, just outlining this resolution, really.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, the quality of adhittana, which is like a resolution or determination. And I mean, it is so important because without that, we give up when things get hard. You know, we can have very good intentions, but if we don't actually persist and continue to make you know, some effort, if you want to call it effort, to see that we're on track towards our aspirations, then we won't get very far. So yeah, the persistence, and that's a quality also that nobody else had mentioned. So maybe it was one of the Buddha's particular strengths. Yeah. Yeah. And remember, the Buddha was practicing to be a fully enlightened Buddha. That requires a lot more resolution and determination than to be an arahat. Of course, he is an arahat, but he's also got the capacity to teach the Dhamma, to discover the Dhamma at a time that it isn't any more available, and to have these incredible teaching skills to be able to spread it far and wide. So the amount of determination you need for that is far more, far, far more. You have to actually go through many more lives also to develop such qualities. Yeah, thank you. And I have also had a lot of determination. That used to be one of my biggest strengths, probably why I sat for 6 hours, and that was part of an 18-hour day. So I have had that a lot as well. And now I'd say it's much more gentle and probably almost lazy in comparison. But there's a place for it within, obviously, a rounded, holistic practice. Yeah. Because remember, the main message of the Buddha's life really was to practice the Eightfold Path, right? There were 8 factors of that path that all have to be developed, and that includes the gentleness and the loving kindness and all the other things. So. Yeah, so last few comments in the chat. Metta Queen Samavati must have illuminated the entire palace. Yes, absolutely. She lived in a palace. She was a Queen Samavati, and she was foremost in loving kindness in the Buddha's day. She was a lay woman and a very wonderful practitioner of loving kindness. And Shirley said, yes, but helped by Kujuttara, who memorized the Dhamma. 2FMTY, what? Heroines, what does that mean? 2FM, huh? FMTY? Heroines. 2 of my heroines. Ah, I thought it was some kind of woman called Lingo.
Heroines.
Ah, right. 2 of your heroines. Brilliant. Excellent. These days I never know. I think it's some kind of jazzy lingo from the younger generation. I thought Shirley was like, because you're hanging out here, you pick something up. excellent. Any last comment from here? Okay, any qualities that we haven't touched upon?
Courage.
Courage. Awesome. Courage.
Social harmony.
Social harmony. The ability to live in harmony with each other, or the condition of social harmony.
Well, I guess like the thing which metta brings to a community to me feels like creating that like harmonious space.
Yeah. Or the thing that the moonlight brings to a forest. That's part of it, isn't it? Beautiful. Yeah. Peaceful, safe space. Yeah. Social harmony. More comments in the chat. The 4 foundations of fellowship. That's interesting. I've not heard of that one. Is that a Buddhist thing or is that a thing in the world? It sounds lovely. Shirley says generosity. Jill says restraint. The beautiful thing about all these qualities is they're like pieces of a cake. You know, they look different, but it actually has all the ingredients in it. So if you have generosity, you end up having all the other things too. I mean, for generosity, you have to have some restraint, right? Patience and contentment. I must say I veer towards these things now. Patience, contentment, gentleness, kindness. For me, this is all right intention or right way of relating. Second factor of the Noble Path. Beautiful. Giving gifts, kindly speech, beneficial conduct and equality. They're the 4 foundations of fellowship. That is the power of support. Giving gifts, kindly speech, beneficial conduct, and the equality. That's beautiful. I love the equality. What about nekama? Can a layperson aspire and develop it? Absolutely. That means renunciation. You renounced all your holiday time to be on retreat. You only have 5 days left, and that's also for Buddhist activities. So that's nekama. You've renounced indulging and fitting away money. You've renounced so many things. Just have a think about what it is you've renounced. You're renouncing unwholesome qualities to cultivate the wholesome as much as you possibly can. You're renouncing ill will to cultivate loving kindness. You know, when Susie saw you just now, she said, you always look so happy. And it's true, because I know why. You practice so much metta. So you often have a smile and a sense of gentleness and joy on your face. So yeah, nekama is wonderful. You know, think about what you can let go more of. I mean, simplify your life. Yeah, but most of all, it's renouncing, abandoning unwholesome states, renouncing craving eventually. Right? Out of all the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha said the second truth, craving, is to be abandoned. Pahana means giving up, abandoning. It's very similar to nekama. And the four ways of letting go, they're all variations on nekama. Chaga, giving, generosity, that's nekama. Patinissaga, anything with nisaga on the end is a kind of letting go. Nisaga, patinissaga is like giving things away, throwing things away. And there's vosaga, which also means letting go. So we've got chaga, patinissaga. Mutti is like freeing ourselves, lightening the load. And analia, letting things fall off us, letting praise and blame and everything just wash off. So yeah, third noble truth. All the qualities mentioned at the beginning of the Metta Sutta, yes, also. And then lastly, Hataka of Alavi was a lay exemplar foremost in gathering a following using the four bases of sympathy. That probably means of compassion or anukampa, and was known for his ability to bring others to Buddhism. Hataka of Alavi. I think, okay, the four bases of sympathy. I didn't know that. I know he's one of the main lay male disciples of the Buddha, so that's wonderful to know. Thank you. Excellent. Thank you so much, everybody. It seems we're out of time and we haven't even done the final little talk from Minori. Do you want to say very quickly a few words, Minori, before I mention the upcoming events? Where's Minori vanished to?
I am here.
Ah, yeah. Super. Yeah. You have to just jump in.
Yeah, very quick few words on dana, that is generosity, and how the anukampa can help us to cultivate this quality. This is a practice that as Buddhists we aspire to develop, and you know that there are ways that we can give the donations, finance donations through the website, and there will be a link in the chat if you don't know. There are different ways, and donation through your standing order donations, online volunteering, meals, providing meals, sending groceries if you are far away. There's so many different ways. And I'll give a little space for Venerable to talk about the events.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm just going to try and remove your spotlight. And now I have to think about which upcoming events there are, which is also a way to be generous. Come to our events and practice the Dhamma. That's generous, isn't it? So what's coming up? So tomorrow here we have a half-day retreat, but I don't think we're Zooming it, but we will be recording it. On next Wednesday we have our usual chanting, and then Friday and Saturday the Sutta and the Metta. And I am working on organising a weekend online retreat. I don't know if it's going to be the 7th and 8th of March. It hopefully still will be, which is short notice. So I'm letting you know now, just in case, because I haven't got the newsletter ready yet. It'll take some time. Otherwise, it'll be in May. What else? We have a Vaisak day on the 30th of May, and that is real time, but we might also allow people to join via Zoom, at least for the session Ajahn Brahm's zooming in for. So if we can set up the tech, we'll do that, because he's joining us for an hour that day. But if you are able to get to Oxford, that's on the 30th of May. And of course, Ajahn Brahmali is coming to England too. All the bookings are going to go up once I have it all arranged. There's still a lot of work to do, and then the newsletter to put out. So everything's getting a bit backlogged. But that's from the 20th till the, no, 13th till the 20th of June. And he'll be here a day before and a couple of days afterwards. So if you are coming to England for that, you can book a couple of days either side. So I think that's all for now. Take care, everybody, and hope to see you somewhere soon.